Every political system has to have a power that is unaccountable, that nobody is watching the election.
By definition.
By definition. Many people in this world do not understand. There are those people, but where are my rights? I'm like, well, what is the power that enforces your rights? Okay, what enforces rights against that power? No, right.
Gödel's incompleteness theorem.
Yeah, it's just like long before Gödel.
I would like to approach our conversation from a first principles perspective. Sure. I know that you've been handling abstractions for the whole day,
yeah.
But I think going to the bare bones of logic is a field on which I could engage with you more properly.
Yes.
Given that the background...
Well, yes. I mean, you have a classical liberal background, and so I've literally read all of Mises and Rothbard. So, you know, yeah.
I'm not here. My intention here wasn't to try to combat your idea,
yep.
But try to understand it.
Yes.
So, from a bare first principles perspective, from a scientific method, I think that every assumption is subject to being disproven in the future. And the fact that democracy is seen as something sacred, I don't believe in sacred cows. And I'm open, at least, to ideas of alternative ways of handling, allocating capital. And the way, for example, companies are handled, there's a clear hierarchy, but there's also the anarchist argument, which I know you are not an anarchist, and that the flatter the hierarchy, the better, because there's more contact with the terrain. So just from the perspective of the scientific method, I think that it would be correct to open our minds to alternative ways of handling resources, given that we already have the evidence in companies being handled by a CEO. Is that the direction?
That's fair. And the thing is, when we look at the empirical evidence of when we start, and it does not finish answering a question, but it starts answering a question, when we look and say, at the most banal level, what is a government? It is a large organization with a single purpose. And when we look at all large organizations, even for values of large that are like 10, you know, but also for values of large that are 10 million, what we see is that the pyramid shaped org chart, which is sort of the heart of, you know, or maybe the lungs of the corporate form, we see the pyramid shaped org chart. And we basically observe this form evolving over and over again in distantly separated societies. And, you know, there's clearly something natural about it. There is a natural order there. And what you see, you know, what I would say about the pyramid shape org chart is that it's almost like the, you know, comparing, you know, that organizational structure to anything else is, I'll use a technical analogy. It's like comparing laminar and turbulent flow in liquids. You know, the pyramid shaped org chart is laminar flow, and it's based, you know, it's most effective when used with the concept of which the US military calls mission type orders. I'm going to butcher the German name, but it's Auftragstaktik. This is a World War I era innovation, and the idea is they don't micromanage. So at every level in this hierarchy, you have a mission, you delegate pieces of that mission to subordinates, you tell them what result you want rather than how they should do their job. And the results is a very flexible structure. Of course, you know, many Americans, some Americans know that the most effective, you know, fighting force in the 20th century was, of course, the German army. But most people are like, that's because of the rigid hierarchical discipline. No, that's actually because of their flexible operating structure. And they really pioneered this form of operation. So you can take it as a given because there are so few counterexamples of large effective organizations which do not use this structure. Like there's a company of Valve that's a game company in Washington State that's a few hundred people, purports to have a flat organizational structure. Yeah, I'm sure actually there's power structures that are just invisible, right? You know, you can have a flat organizational structure with like three people. you know, and but once you have board, you need a hierarchy. And so the like, okay, you have a large organization that needs to get things done, and it terminates at a single point. However, you know, we know from all kinds of engineering and computer science even, that single points of failure are bad. Do you know what a Jesus nut is?
Jesus nut.
Jesus nut.
No, I don't.
You have a helicopter, and the helicopter has a rotor and blades that spin around, and the rotor has to be attached to the mast. That can only be done by a single part.
Mm-hmm.
That's called the Jesus nut. Mm. And if you have a fracture in the Jesus nut, your rotor falls off and your helicopter turns into a rocket. That's a single point of failure.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have systems, you can engineer systems with single points of failure. It exists. It's a thing. And it's also a thing to be avoided whenever possible. So you're like, okay. I think that one of the things I've said to other people, how do you find a good king CEO? I'm like, basically any Fortune 500 CEO will do okay. Right? Anyone, I mean, you know, this, the job is banal, it's straightforward, it does not involve this like deep spiritual genius. Yes, it could be done with genius or it could be done with competence. I'd be pretty fine with competence at this point because I feel that the job is not being done with competence. But okay, you can make the Jesus nut out of anything, but okay, you pick the Fortune 500 CEO, he gets brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he starts doing a little funny in the head, you know, like, you know. I usually, you know, joke that the way people are afraid of kings and CEOs and leaders is if they expected the CEO of Chipotle burritos to start poisoning the burritos. You know, it's like, well, we poison the burritos and then we'll sell the antidote. I'm like, no, that's not reality. But hey, you get the guy who gets a brain tumor, he becomes evil. All right, we have to seriously consider that possibility, or he's just incompetent. And that's why you need what we call corporate governance. I did a lecture on this at Stanford GSV, and what I always say when I have corporate governance in the sovereign level, and I'm like, it's not governance, it's accountability. Mm-hmm. It is not part of the governing structure of the company. It is a backup mechanism for the governing structure of the company, and it's a system that it should be engaged only when the governing structure of the company goes wrong. The genius of the board of directors is the fact that your directors are independent means, sometimes you use executives on the board, but you really want independent directors. Those independent directors cannot in any way be corrupted. They cannot develop conflicts of interest by also functioning as management. If you, let's say you're running a software company and you put the VP of engineering on the board, the VP of engineering has some pet project that he really loves and he just can't see past it, and he'd be fine on the board of any other company, but he should not be on the board of his own company. This is why the board needs to be like removed from the management process and should talk to the CEO ideally only 4 times a year. Right, because otherwise it sort of gets corrupted by power. And then above the board, you have backup mechanism number 2, which is the shareholder votes. So if the board gets screwed up, the shareholders, and again, you see with the shareholders, people are like, a shareholder voting, oh, it's like democracy. No, it's not like democracy, because actually, by definition, there's no conflict of interest between shareholders. Mm-hmm. They all want exactly the same thing, which is number go. So their interests are aligned so they can operate collectively without politics and without conflicts of interest. You know, the Chipotle shareholders all have the same interests.
To different degrees?
No, not to any different
degree. They're not equally invested.
Well, no, yes, per share. And they vote per share as well. So sure. We share, right? And otherwise, yes, if we did it per shareholder, there would be conflicts,
yeah.
Right? But if we do it per share, there are no conflicts.
And okay. What is the share?
What
would be the share in this governance structure?
You can't do it that way. And so I'm describing the corporate sort of second order non-sovereign structure. And then I'm going to go from there to the sovereign structure.
Okay.
And I'm just trying to get the sort of the right picture of the non-sovereign government structure, which you probably understand better than some, but, you know, let's get that in place first.
Mm-hmm.
So what's neat about the shareholders and the structure, again, you know, if you have the Chipotle customers vote on the next burrito flavor, well, some like one thing, some like another, you know, so there's conflicts, there's politics. You know, not everybody wants the cactus seeds in the burrito. But some love it. But, you know, you have like the vegetarian burritos fighting against the meat burritos, right? Mm-hmm. And you look at the vegetarian party and the meat party, and all these shit show in an incredible fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear the word shit show was used in German. Is this correct?
I'm fairly fluent in German, but it's not my mother tongue.
Ah, got it. You speak Swiss German?
No, Hochdeutsch, High German. I think I wouldn't be the best person to ask.
Yeah, fine. So the goal of the corporate accountability mechanism, which makes the CEO an accountable monarch, is the most interesting and the most poorly understood sort of version of the system. So let's go sort of in the direction of the sovereign corporation a little bit. You know, our next step upward is the companies with dual share classes, such as, for example, Facebook. Meta has a dual share class. And so actually the whole board mechanism is disabled in Meta because the CEO has majority voting shares. I could check it. I could be wrong, but I believe Mark Zuckerberg still has majority voting shares. Mm-hmm. There are simply two classes of shares, and he has had superpowers, perfectly legal. Another example of this is the New York Times Company.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times Company, again, dual class share structure. Only descendants of Adolf Ochs have class A shares, and there's a lot of them, and they'll have to vote to pick a new leader. The New York Times is practically sovereign in many ways. I mean, certainly it's not accountable to any external organization, right? Which is pretty close to the definition of sovereignty, and it can certainly destroy anything they like. So you're close to sovereignty there. Something that's very like the New York Times system is the system in Saudi Arabia. Here we get closer to, we are at a sovereign level, they're actually quite sovereign. It's not really clear how the Saudi princes, who are all descendants of Ibn Saud, pick MBS or any new ruler. I doubt that they have a formal system of voting, although they might. I don't think anybody really knows. There's a lot of politics. But still, you have the sense that you have a large pool of people who feel responsible for the success of the overall system and are basically willing to kind of follow that idea. And so you basically get, with the structure, you get efficient, accountable leadership. And if there was a better way to build something that would outcompete the classic Anglo-Dutch, I think it's originally a Dutch design of the joint stock company, we would have seen it by now. So empirically, this is the most effective way to run an organization. So, all right, now we transfer to the sovereign level. At the sovereign level, there are certain problems that do not appear at the non-sovereign level. One is, what even is the purpose of this thing? You know, in the private sector, it's easy. Well, you're making money and you're making official government currency of this government, right? You're like, okay, but what's the purpose of the state at this level? How do you measure the performance? What's that even mean? Okay, that's a problem. Then your other problem is, okay, how do I make the board of directors above the CEO when you can just arrest them and have them killed?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't work, right? Your system breaks down, no accountability there. And you're back and you might as well not have just accountability structure at all, because basically this year we'll just, you know, arrest them and destroy them. and also how you make the company obey the CEO. In the private sector, it's easy. The government says, yes, no, this guy is in charge of the corporation. And if he says you're fired, you're fired.
Uh-huh.
Right. You know, but then at the sovereign level, it's more like, you know, that great Batman line. Do you feel in charge? You know, and so you have these problems. And I'm just like, this is a straightforward problem of adapting a working solution in one engineering domain to be a solution in a different domain. And these seem like solvable problems to me. And even more intriguing, some of these problems are solvable in the 21st century, but not in any previous century. So if you have a new thing that couldn't be done, that could be done before, you ask the question, well, why didn't somebody do this before? If you have a new thing that couldn't be done before, you don't have to answer that question because it's an obvious answer. So let's start with the problem of getting the government to obey the CEO and not like just true, like with the Praetorian Guard or something. Well, the U.S. in the 1960s developed this technology for nuclear bombs called the permissive action number, PAL. If you've heard of the nuclear football,
Rings a bell.
Yeah. So basically, with the U.S. president, this is a Cold War thing. With the U.S. president at all times, any time of day or night, he's got to be ready to nuke Russia.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to be ready to nuke Russia. And how does he nuke Russia? Well, you know, the first generation of nuclear bombs, it was just like, well, it's like any weapon, whoever has the weapon to launch it. Right. And somebody watched Dr. Strangelove and he said, you know, what if General Jack D. Ripper decides to nuke Russia all on his own?
Mm-hmm.
That was a concern. And the result was, okay, you're going to have every nuclear weapon have special arming codes so that until it hears the codes, it will not fire. And then those codes are kept in a briefcase of the guy who is walking next to the president at all times. And then, okay, maybe the guy would start using the codes himself and nukes the president. I don't know, it's not realistic, right? But this is all 1960s technology. And we've learned a lot about semiconductors since then. And it is actually quite feasible to apply this technology to every weapon.
Mm-hmm.
People who love guns hate this idea, but we're not in America, so nobody loves guns here. So you basically say, all right, you have military, every weapon in this military is locked to a cryptographic key.
Mm-hmm.
It will not fire if the key is not right, if the signature is not right. And so what you're saying is basically only the legitimate government has weapons. And if you basically rebel against the legitimate government, your gun stop on.
Mm-hmm.
And you lose. All right, this is pretty good. But then you're just like, all right, this doesn't solve a problem of getting CEO to obey the board. Right? Because how does that work with the codes? What? And nothing stops him from arresting the board. And, you know, you can arrest the board with billy clubs or swords if needed. Right? But, you know. And there is another wonderful solution here, which is this great technology that somebody invented about 15 years ago. It's called the blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about the blockchain is that it's actually above sovereignty. It's the whole point of the blockchain is that it's a power, it's a limited power. It can't kill people, but it's above sovereignty and it can resist sovereignty, which is a thing that had not been seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So this basically, you know, comes to the idea of a secret board. You're basically saying, okay, every political system has to have a power that is unaccountable, that nobody is watching that.
By definition.
Many people in this globe do not understand. There are some people, but where are my rights? I'm like, well, what is the power that enforces your rights? Okay, what enforces rights against that power? No, right.
Gödel's incompleteness theory.
Yeah, it's just like long before Gödel, you know, it's like Aristotle's incompleteness theorem, you know, and like, you know, this this basic reality of political science has to compete with these gassy abstractions of the 20th century. But yes, so you have to design a body that, number one, is not a governing body, but an accountability body, because if it's governing, it's too involved and it'll get corrupted. Ideally, this body is made up of people for whom it's not even the main thing in their lives. You know, that's true for a drug board director. You know, it's not a full-time job. You just show up occasionally and like listen to the CEO talk about, you know, his results and be like, okay, that's good. You can stay, you know, and go home and do your CEO of a different company. Right. By the way, one way of making the board independent of the CEO is just to have a lot of different nations and scatter them around different nations. Mm-hmm. Stupid works. And in fact, the nations can even hold each other's shares. This is something that's done in Japan extensively. They have these Keiretsu structures where companies hold each other's shares, and these cross shareholdings create interesting, you know, alignment structures.
Others call it collusion, but yeah.
Well, yeah, no, actually, you can have like collusion. It does create an incentive for monopolies to behave in a monopoly like that. And exercise monopoly pricing power. But in Japan, they tend to hold the oligopolies, so sure. And the point is that this structure is possible. But I mean, there are many ways to solve or attack this problem, absolutely none of which are perfect. But you basically, what you want is a board, is an independent board that is independent enough to not be corrupted by power or incentives. You basically, moreover, you want them to actually be as independent of each other as possible, because what you really don't want your board to do, and remember, there's no power stopping it from doing that, is kind of merge together to a big junta and like become a parliament or something, become the real government.
Unless that would be less efficient and would be outcompeted by smaller structures.
Yeah, but you would also like, yes, you're making, by turning the board into a parliament, you're creating a multipolar, you're creating, you know, what we call checks and balances. The Romans called imperium and imperio. And I was very shocked to discover that the thing in worship was considered a phallus. Yeah. Because imagine Apple, you know, being governed by, a parliament and a Supreme Court. The Supreme Court would ensure the rights of users. You know, the parliament would decide on the new features, right? You know, your laptop would be as slow as a calculator and the size of this row, right? And so you need to keep that monarchical quality. You need to keep the accountability. And it's a somewhat delicate system to design and actually make work well. Here is the way that I think it plays out in practice. First of all, you need a way to establish the structure, which is really, there's fundamentally, if you're creating any architecture of monarchy, that architecture has to be created by a monarch who's actually absolute. So you really do have to find someone you can trust completely, but you also have a way for that person that you trust completely to create a system whose trustworthiness is above his own life.
And mind you, we already have all our trust put into the voters.
Yes, of which were, you know, absolutely terrible. So remembering, you know, let's remember that, you know, this system can't be perfect. No system can be perfect, but the perfect was then made the good. And it doesn't have to be 100% safe. It's like encryption. Your encryption is not 100% safe ever. It is 99.99999999% safe, which is enough for most people, but an accident, you know, so the accident in the clear text is the same as the ciphered text. But in practice, it never happens. And so what you want is, you're not looking for something that can't break. You're looking for something that is engineered so that in practice, it would be very surprising if it broke.
Yep.
And First of all, the blockchain makes it extremely easy to be an anonymous director who's not only unknown to the CEO, but is also unknown to the other directors.
Mm-hmm.
This makes it very hard to collude and like sort of form, you know, gather the board back into a central structure. If you go, first of all, you can only talk to your fellow board members in a room containing all of them. If you make an improper suggestion in that room, it's not going to go anywhere. The difficulty of assembling all of that power in a way which everyone feels is improper, and where there's actually, besides just ambition and general fuckery, there's no incentive to basically, you know, recollect the board, is there. And then you're like, okay, well, we still have a succession problem within this board.
Mm-hmm.
So how is the board established? Again, you basically, you find someone that you trust. The model is to say, all right, let's say I'm Bukele in El Salvador, or Kagame, another great leader in Luanda. Okay, I have a mission that is greater than my life. I have a mission to like preserve this country. I really believe in saving this nation, but I also know I'm gonna die because I'm here. And when I die, I want to be replaced by someone who I feel is carrying on my vision. Back in sort of normal human psychology here. So, all right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to basically find like a reasonably large number, like odd number. Like I'm going to find 29 of my friends, people that I really trust and respect and love, and I'm going to make them directors. And those people are going to choose my successor when I die. In fact, I might give them the power to replace me during my life.
Uh-huh.
But I basically, a situation in which a majority of these people decide to do something irresponsible and stupid and evil and self-dealing, it's going to be very hard to put together that majority. Then, so that these people are immune to any future CEO, I know who they are, but nobody else knows who they are. If they choose a successor, they have to be above that successor. So what I say is, all right, I'm giving all 29 of you one of each magic tokens. I don't know who's who. I don't know who gets what token. And if you're doxxed, if your identity becomes public in any way, or if you die, of course, you've got to pass it on.
Okay, can I?
And so almost done. Sorry. Almost done. And so what you're essentially saying is you've got this kind of secret fraternity of guardians in a way that, you know, anytime you need a successor, you choose your own successor.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there will be some drift. Maybe there will be some like shit tier losers who will pick something even more. And so you've got a structure that, you know, with enough redundancy can last really for thousands of years in this situation. And nobody has a conflict of interest. Nobody has an incentive to misbehave. And sort of random, willful misbehavior is kind of dealt with by the very high level of redundancy of the system. So this is a system in which, at least in theory, the mission can be preserved for a very long time. And then we remember, of course, that so many monarchies worked really quite well without any such system. Plenty of completely unaccountable despots did just fine. Mark Zuckerberg has no accountability mechanism. I don't know if Elon has an effective board. I would doubt it. Actually, absolute monarchy has worked reasonably well. Even absolute hereditary monarchy has worked reasonably well. We don't see any Hitlers coming out of that process or that situation. Moreover, this is not the only way to basically solve the succession problem. For example, one of the problems with hereditary monarchies in the past is you have air failure, you have, you know, biological, you know, Henry Days, you have failures to conceive the sun, you have et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, technology again comes to the rescue. You know, you're the king, you want to have 200 kids and pick the best one and raise them all on a stool for princes, and, you know, somebody wins and is the next king. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a supremely well-adjusted, psychologically tested to within an inch of his life, you know, individual, like, you know, you're going to get a super winning game, especially now that you can do genomic selection, right? Once again, totally different mechanism, solve the problem much better than it was solved in the past. And then, like, already, even if we take unmodified historical monarchy, its track record is generally bad. It's the track record of democracy in many different ways. We don't see a lot of the greats, and even the mediocre things are like the ordinary Fortune 500 CEO. Like, you know, we don't call them the great, but like the country is essentially fine. And so that's a question, you know, that is fundamentally, that's in a way one part of the solution, which is that, like, okay, if you can collect the power needed for this change into one place, this is what you do with it. Does that follow so far?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was thinking that I wanted to make two points about that, which is that maybe there could be analogies made about Europe, because we were developing now a topic of one issue about Europe, and your insights relating in some way to Europe would be very useful to us. But I think that I was constantly thinking of every level that you were explaining about biology and how there's analogies of governance, sure, of resources being handled, of how we allocate the, let's say, existential capital of how do ants collect what, based on what judgment, what is the hierarchy like. And so I would like to make an analogy with biology to be able to think about this, because there has to be Elon, for example, the example you gave.
Yeah.
Elon might seem to be an absolute monarch from the outside, as if he has complete power of his own structure, but he's not completely an absolute monarch, because he's a living being. So he is subject to his fruit provider to provide to him something, or the suppliers of Tesla.
Yeah, he's not sovereign, certainly, and he's responsible, certainly, to the U.S. government, which is going to treat him very badly if the Democrats ever get back in there.
And that has to be the case by definition, I think, because in every biological system, in every ecology, there's a fitness structure. The fitness, ability to survive and reproduce in an environment, is always codependent.
Well, yes. So you have the thing is that you have, for example, in a state, you have external forces. And your external forces, you know, if you were a small state, you know, are the countries around you. And that's sort of the failure mode. The classical failure mode is you fail and are taken over by your neighbors. And that's a failure mode that's been quite gentle by 20th century standards. Just like, oh, the flag changed. You know, if you're an ordinary person and not a warrior, you're like, oh, the flag changed. I have to send my tax payments to a different address. Right. It's actually not a huge deal at all. If there is a single world state, it's more problematic, and that's part of the reason why I don't like the idea of a single world state.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're having the redundancy of our structure is quite important.
And that evolved independently in biology, by the way.
Yeah. And the competitive redundancy is a principle that we see in many, many layers. Let me throw another wrinkle into this, however, which is that the system of essentially, competing distributed city-states, if you will, the kind of the patchwork vision, all very well and good. But if you're actually sovereign, remember that there's no power over you. And so when you're actually sovereign and you have a dispute with your neighbor, it's under the principles of Ultima, you know, Arati Regum, which Louis XIV had, engraved on his canons, the last argument of kings.
Mm-hmm.
So in the sort of the classical view of international law, a nation is essentially a A nation as a firm, when two firms in the private sector are fighting, they sue each other, but at the sovereign level, they go to war. Right. And the sort of system of judgment in which basically war almost by definition results in the victory of the strongest, be it Darwinian competition among states, which leaves only strong and competent states.
But there's no alternative to that.
There's what?
There's no alternative to that.
There's no alternative to that. And yet the problem is that it's not as clear that it works as described in the 21st century. So there are one of the sort of essential observations of history, and this is made in like an interminable 1,000-page book by the international relations scholar Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's professor at Georgetown, that political arrangements are always a function of military arrangements, and military arrangements are always a function of military technology. Military technology creates the shape of the state in a way. And military technology in the present world is arguing very strongly for a single global state, because the locus of power today is really important.
But that's like saying the claws of the cat determine the shape of the cat. Of course, because the cat has to interact with its environment, with its claws.
Indeed, indeed. And so, in a way, understanding that technology causes not just commercial globalization, but also military globalization is, I think, it's in a way the strongest case for World War II. Mm-hmm. It's the strongest. It's like, okay, somebody's going to do it, so we better do it, and you have a race for this, orbit is one place, is the problem. Space is one place. And because it's one place, somebody's going to be in charge of it. And we have this stupid treaty that was signed between Leonid Brezhnev and Lyndon Johnson saying we won't militarize space. I guess I take those two individuals very seriously. So let's not. No.
That's camouflage.
It was less important at the time. But military realities always take precedence. The military reality that we're about to be in is that the U.S. has a huge advantage in heavy lift capacity over China. And that will be true for at least a few years until they can rip off Starship. What that means is that, and one half of this is already being worked on, albeit at, I'm sure, slow UV paces, it's called Golden Dome. The fundamental idea is that not just missile defense, but actually like default destroy, you should, like, unless if you're sending a rocket into space, whether it's a satellite or an ICBM or whatever, basically it will be detected by this system. Unless you have prior approval, mm-hmm. it will be destroyed. That's what you do in war. You monopolize space. Mm-hmm. And I'm very much an advocate of us doing this before the Chinese do it, because the Chinese will do it. Now, it's hard to have a monopoly only with defensive weapons, because defensive weapons, like a launched mine system like this, can be attacked in various ways from the ground. There are anti-satellite missiles, there are anti-satellite lasers. So you really can't have a system that has no defense and no offense. That, of course, leads you to the next piece of the space war dominance puzzle, which is Project Thor, also called Rods from God. Mm-hmm. What you do is you use this enormous heavy lift capacity and put a bunch of basically tungsten telephone poles mm-hmm. in orbit. And then in like 5 minutes, if you want to blow us up, you can deorbit that pole lining. It's going to get right here. And it's going to have like a kiloton of TNT explosion. A tungsten telephone pole moving at Mach 18, that's a lot of damage. Mm-hmm. Right. So without worrying about boots on the ground or ground troops or navies or anything, basically the technology of absolute unipolar single state world domination is like right around the corner. And it's somewhat tricky, even when you put this up and people have like a nuclear deterrent, you have to put it up without giving an incentive to fire the nuclear deterrent, you know, to preempt it. I can avoid that anyway. Point is, basically, that level of power is so great that actually that same trick that China played when it created capitalism inside communism can be played again. Mm-hmm. So essentially, China was like, all right, our state is so strong that we can have a virtual layer of like mini states within that. These mini states are companies, they don't have armies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're doing this in the real world and you have basically global domination, even with global domination, you still, I think, want the world to flourish. If nothing else, so they can buy more expensive whiskey. You want the world to flourish. Let's say Elon starts using Starship to send up punks and rods.
Was there ever full world domination by one single government?
No, and it's slightly terrifying, of course, because it really raises the idea of world domination. Now, the closest thing is, of course, you know, FDR in 1945. FDR thought that he'd won a world war and created a world government, which was the United Nations, but actually, because the USSR had voted, it turned out to not be the case. The USSR did not want to be allowed that. And they would have collapsed a long time ago if they decided to be our laptop. And
could we connect these? Because
I've almost connected it back. Okay. It's a long digression, but I'm almost connected it back. So in a way, if you remember me talking about the government of China being so strong that it feels free to allow capitalism within the state, just as, you know, sort of, you know, Deng Xiaoping is like, our communist state, the Mao leftist, is so strong that we can allow these capitalist powers to exist. And, you know, if they get uppity, we'll just, you know, throw them in jail. Lenin tried that 100 years previously in the new economic policy. He was scared by it. He didn't let it happen. He was like, this lower layer of power basically is over. Yeah.
They will mutate into a cancer.
Yeah, that's right. It went and threatened the layer above.
Yeah.
So if you have orbital supremacy, basically, you are the government of the world. But your incentive in being the government of the world, it's like the incentive of Deng Xiaoping being the government of China. You want the whole thing to thrive. And the way to make the whole thing thrive is to have another Darwinian level below you. And
it's like a fractal.
Yes, it's like a fractal. And in the world of the world of power that I'm imagining, it's like, okay, you want the world to be worth as much as possible. You want it to thrive. Therefore, actually, the power that controls orbit, call it the orbital authority, actually has an incentive to establish a lower layer beneath it.
Yeah.
And that lower layer has to be limited in power because you don't want that lower layer of sovereignty building their own rockets and their own and challenging orbital dominance. Mm-hmm. But actually, it is your incentive as the orbital hegemon to avoid intervening in conflicts between terrestrial powers for the same reason that the Trump administration doesn't care whether OpenAI beats Anthropic or vice versa.
They have to figure it out themselves.
They have to figure it out themselves, and you want, you know, you will keep the whole system strongest by having the strongest player win. And so what you can do is you can say, all right, we have tiers of conflict. Top tier is orbital and nuclear conflict. One step down from that is industrial conventional war as we know it today. In order to keep our tiers separate from each other, then you say, we're going to actually skip a tier. We want this orbital authority to be as non-threatened by the virtual entities below it as like the Chinese Communist Party is not threatened by financial Jack Ma. So we're not going to have any industrial warfare at all. Industrial warfare is bad. And instead, we're going to say, fine, these terrestrial states, they can do all kinds of technical things. But if they want to go to war, They have to do artisanal Homeric warfare. No firearms, no guns, no explosives, nothing that burns, no electricity, no compressed gases. It's basically the Iliad down there. And so that creates basically those states have to maintain, in order to survive in that sense, they have to maintain their energy, they have to maintain their health, they have to maintain the strength to be able to recruit fighting men who will fight with hand weapons against other men, just as we saw in Toto's hat.
That's interesting what we already have, because companies cannot compete with each other in whichever ways they want. That's if right. I build a company, I cannot compete against yours using violence. There's a monopoly to that.
Exactly right. Exactly right. You grasped it perfectly. And so, you know, we're saying in this form, which is different, there is violence. But the violence does not, you know, the violence is noble violence. Mm-hmm. It is not, you know, you're blown up by a drone or a nuclear weapon or something. It's like, actually, you know, we want to have warriors and the warriors should be great warriors. And it will be natural that basically the country would be governed by these warriors because the warrior class is always in charge.
And there's no alternative.
We
already have a warrior now.
Yeah, we already have a warrior now. And so you basically have this governing system where the top level is this orbital authority. Men don't even have people on Earth. They might have like one island that they shoot, you know, they launch the rockets off of. And they're basically a bunch of like nerds not connected to humanity. Mm-hmm. And that's great. They can be nerds. And then the rest of society lives down in sort of regular world, which is kind of a simulation of history without advanced military technology. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of get history back in a way under this, because Sparta can go to war with Athens exactly as it did 2,500 years ago, mm-hmm. using the same tools that it did 2,500 years ago. And except that they'll have iPhones when they get home.
Let me make an analogy. Do you know how a clear page is not the best for creativity? Because you need some constraints.
Yeah.
So if I was allowed to come into this interview in whichever way I really wanted, if naked would be one of the options in the menu, it wouldn't lead to a very productive interaction. So that the channels, that the options are restricted leads to a possible interaction.
Yes. And it's like, this is the structure where you're like, you know, when you think about the way like most people think about designing political structures, they're constantly making engineering mistakes because they're evoking powers that don't actually exist, or they're imagining self-watching watchdogs, or we should allow this, and who is this we, right? Actually, the art of designing this system is the art of designing something which does not break down, which has all of the, you know, in which there is no incentive or capacity to sort of degrade the system into something that doesn't actually work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite convinced that this, I mean, you know, never say eternity, never say ever, but like, if there's any system that can survive stably for thousands of years as a political order, I think it's this one.
And to bring it back to biology, I think that that has been the case always, that we allow variation in the edges, but the core of it, the means by which proteins are, the sequence of that building, yeah. The basic proteins, the building blocks by which we're made, those don't mutate. And when they mutate, the reliability by which those are corrected is huge, approximating 100%. So we allow variability in the edges, but not in the core, exactly like the Chinese Communist Party does.
Yeah, and so you're basically, whenever you have a Jesus nut or a single point of failure, that Jesus nut needs to be designed very carefully. Mm-hmm. The orbital authority here is a Jesus nut, and it actually doesn't have an incentive to screw with the system. It has the power to screw with the system. It has the power to mess it up, but nobody has any reason to.
But that person is alive.
Which person is alive?
The Jesus nut. It's a being that's alive. It requires oxygen, food.
But no, the system. So if you're going back to the governance of the orbital authority, mm-hmm. yes, there's a, you know, if you do your accountability structure right, mm-hmm. the CEO is not actually Jesus nut. because you can lose that CEO and you have a very non-single point of failure board that can come in and do that replacement. But if the board is doing the governing itself, the whole thing is ruined.
Mm-hmm.
And so you basically are, you're looking for, you're trying to create a system, and you know, you could argue with some details of this construction, but I think it all seems pretty straightforward to me. You're trying to create a system where there is no incentive to break the system. You're not saying that if all of humanity goes crazy at the same time, of course nothing can survive that. But if you have no incentive to break the system,
or less, at least less incentive.
At least less incentive. And yeah, we may 0.00001 incentive to break the system. You have something that actually can be quite durable, where we can basically enjoy the benefits of a completely stable government without worrying that we'll go down the Lenin, Stalin, Hitler rabbit.
Let me poke at your brain, bringing this back to Europe to see whether we can connect this context to what happens in Europe and the history of Europe. From my perspective, I happen to have been born in Spain. I moved to Switzerland. Right. I think that one of the reasons why Switzerland is a more functional country is that it's more decentralized. It has a governing structure that is diversified. The Germans don't fuck with the French, and the French don't fuck with the Italians. They are separated. So their identity is diversified. The Swiss are not German. They're not French. They're not Italian. They're something else. They're a mixture of these cultures. And that doesn't allow for a single culture to emerge and be dominant. So this diversification of their cultures is what I think has allowed no single state to take full control of the economy.
Since today's the Helvetic Republic, but that was different. You basically like designing stable, decentralized systems that don't follow the natural tendency to spontaneously re-centralize is hard. I think, you sort of clearly see like the problem that is being solved here in basically, yes, if 29 people go crazy at the same time, the system will re-centralize. But building that stable multipolarity is basically really hard. The other thing, though, to remember about Switzerland is that, Switzerland has always existed within an international order of some kind. It sort of becomes the kind of, in a way, the center of like Protestant Europe and the Protestant Revolution. And
the Bolshevik.
What?
And the Bolshevik, the communist revolution as well.
Yes. Well, a Catholic would tell you that communism and Protestantism is a difference of degree. But, also Switzerland has made significant sovereignty compromising moves. So for example, the loss of banking secrecy was, completely stupid. And they're like, wow, what if our banks could merge with the banks outside the, Switzerland? Oh, wait, does that mean that America could regulate us? And so
this is the common reporting standard.
Yes. And
by which the US doesn't apply.
Exactly. And they just, but they left themselves open. They were not careful enough about preserving the multipolarity. And when you look at the sort of the world order of today, you see a lot of things which purport to be multiple poles, but are actually not. Switzerland, who knows, but because it is not actually conceivable for the cantons to go to war against each other or something ridiculous like that, there's a way in which the system isn't good of a toy when that is not possible. And of course, you see extensive intercantonal violence in Switzerland before 400 years ago, something mm-hmm. like that. There's a reason why the Swiss Guards protect the Pope, because people were extremely tough. And so actually giving that, the way to preserve everything in many ways wants to collapse together into one thing. And preserving a kind of centrifugal force that keeps the decentralized system decentralized mm-hmm. without anyone being in charge of it and ordering it to be decentralized, because then you're back to, your Jesus nut again, is like, it's like a system software design problem. It's just like you're designing a network and a structure of incentives, which you don't want to become degenerate and collapse into a broken form. Of course, the system is still populated by human beings. And if you populate the whole system by human beings who are human devils, you'll get a system that behaves as a gigantic human devil, right? But, avoiding that still matters and is still important. But the fact that you can even picture, no matter how science fictional it is, I always have problems pitching something like this to, I haven't pitched you, but to pitch it to that room downstairs, and you saw me sort of try and like, right. And, one-on-one with a real smart class for liberals, a little different, right? I don't exactly know how you sell this. I've not had very great luck in selling it, but I'm also very confident that it is a system that could work.
You haven't had success selling it. Do you know how many people are supporting your ideas? Or
not this idea specifically.
Oh, no.
Well, it's the negative ideas that sell the best. The red pill, everybody's bought it. It's become not only part of the English language, but it's rarer, actually. Now you're this pill, you're Camel pill, or whatever pill. And I'm like, did I do that? Yes, in fact, I did. But in fact, do you say pill in German also?
Pill. Oh, I don't know. I think not.
In English, but the language is different at this point.
Huh.
So, and such is the state of our formerly multipolar order. And another sort of picture that you can have in this, another way of sort of preserving that independence, is people talk about isolationism. And what they mean when they talk about isolationism in the 1930s context is, that's a pejorative, it's actually neutralism. But isolationism has actually been practiced on this planet. And a very good example is Japan before the mid-19th century, which basically was like, all right, yes, we'll trade with the world, but only on this island through these goods. We're not going to have cultural contact. America, for some reason, can't even pull that up.
But then there you can have the pretension of isolationism because you have the geography allowing you to do it.
Yes,
but you wouldn't be able to enforce it.
But geography can at least be simulated by human action, right? And the thing is...
To some extent.
And the thing is that, a job for the orbital authority. And the thing is, when Japan was independent, truly independent, culturally independent, Japan had, there was a whole world of Japanese mathematics, for example, which is developing. It's true in the same way as Western mathematics, but all these, see some of the same theorems that monks used to idle the days, grouping theorems and a totally different mathematical system than our system. That's all gone now. And the more, if you want to increase the productive value of human culture, let's say, here's an example. Let's say you could take zero. Okay, it's geographically isolated, so isolated that they didn't have COVID for a while until they fucked it up. But we'll blast it out into space, no possibility of contact with the rest of humanity, and then we'll see how they do. Well, no contact with the rest of humanity.
There has to be a way of contact because they left. So that same path has to kind of
come. It's a thought experiment. It's an unrealistic thought experiment.
Okay.
But the unrealistic thought experiment is to say, okay, New Zealand spends 100 years out in space, mm-hmm. comes back. And what does it come back with? It comes back with New Zealand science and New Zealand cars and New Zealand movies and New Zealand food. And all of these things have diverged from the rest of humanity. And now, instead of having one kind of physics, you have two kinds of physics. All right. Instead of having one kind of art, you have two kinds of art. Maybe they come to the same conclusions. Maybe they start doing the same thing. This is how humanity evolved its amazing, like, variety of, like, food. You know, if instant transportation had been prevailed all across the globe, we would have only one cuisine. And so actually, in this view, this is the sort of extreme patchwork kind of view. We're just like, again, from the perspective of the orbital authority, we are actually maximizing the health of the planet by deglobalizing. Because deglobalizing results in more science, more cultural production, more, it's just a better world.
But there's marginal decreasing returns to deglobalizing.
Yes.
At some point, you get too isolated. So you need convergence.
You need the right, you need to sort of draw optimal state sizes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, when you see, like, we've traveled, like, a long, we should probably call it quits, but we've traveled a sort of long distance in kind of designing the future here. And it's like, all right, yeah, this is a little bit autistic with, like, the secret block. People are watching Board of Directors. Like, yeah, it's autistic, but, like, you know, a lot of things are autistic. A jet airplane is autistic, and yet it works, right? And the problem of governing the 21st century, when people are like, wow, this is very complicated and it could all go spectacularly wrong. This is true. And the same is true of an Airbus A380. And yet, you know, we've never had an A380 crash.
Maybe we don't have a big enough sample. 10x the sample.
Yes, 10x the sample. But the thing is, actually, this is a system. It's hard to even picture a global crash of this. Pieces of it will fail in various ways, but it's actually very redundant and very resilient. And this design could not be more different than the 20th century international water. All right, one more question.
It was just a follow-up a comment on what you were saying, because I see an analogy with electricity or with computing. It's useful to you to do parallel processing for many tasks, but also linear processing.
Yeah.
So I think you have to have, maybe not 50-50 wouldn't be the right proportion, but we have to have both. And having the world transition towards a unipolar world, like the US did post-World War I, and especially after the fall of the Soviet Union, where the U.S. was as dominant as an empire has ever gotten across the whole world.
Yeah.
And they happen to share a lot of my values, so I'm a bit biased here in judging them.
That's right.
But that leads to less of the convergence between the different sciences, because we're not allowing the Japanese to study their mathematics in their way.
Yeah.
So I think we need some kind of single processing to put enough effort into it, but simultaneously have different people see it from different perspectives.
Yeah, because there's a sort of, you know, just as there's an optimal size of the firm, there's an optimal size of the nation. And that's often, you know, if you're really like one of mine for economic purposes, which basically, because people are going to have to find artificial forms of what to do. I don't think countries should run trade deficits. I think that trade deficits create debt relationships between countries, which create power structures between countries.
The trade deficit means that you're printing money and sending it to them. Isn't that a good deal to?
No, it's not, because actually that's a good deal, and it means you're borrowing to live. And that's typically not a good deal.
But you can defund them. You can print them out of existence, their own savings, because they're saving in your currency.
Yeah, I think they'll actually choose to save in another currency before, that happens. But actually, it's just like the having, essentially the way you use your trade deficits is you do a system design described by Warren Buffett called import certificates. I think the actual inventor is Delmar Schott, but let's stick with Warren Buffett on this one. And if no shot. And, you know, the idea is just that if you want to basically pay for something, you know, this gets into a discussion of kind of mercantilist economics in the state as firm, which I don't think we have time for, but I would very much encourage you to read Friedrich List.
Friedrich List.
Friedrich List, who invented new mercantilism, basically. Like the whole system of China, Japan, Korea today, not to mention Germany in the late 19th century, is the system of List.
I think this is one of the points where we would disagree, I think, because behind that, I see Keynes somewhere.
No, I think actually, no, Keynes is not good economics. No, actually, the synthesis of List and Mises is a question that both might argue with in a way, but like, I think that's just because Mises, of course, is a classical liberal, and List is, of course, a mercantilist. And yet, those things actually, they reduce to the same equations, you might say. And but again, you know, if you look at the degree of reinvention you've touched here, and you haven't even touched reinventing the financial system, that is something that actually needs reinvention. And once again, it's all about the first principles.
There hasn't been parallel processing on the financial system.
It's a very hard and interesting problem. And you sort of come in, you know, to sum it up in a way, I think the discussion for first principles is excellent because you sort of grow up inside this system. I was born in 1973. What year were you born?
In 2001.
2001. And you're just like, oh, here's this big, complicated grown-up system that must work, and everybody tells me it's great. And then you look at it, and you're like, wait a second, it's actually crap. You know,
in comparison to what? What's your benchmark?
Sorry?
You have to have a benchmark to see that something is crap.
Well, and that's a hard problem. You have to, well, from first principles, sometimes you can say this system could be more optimal.
There's orders of magnitude of improvement, like Elon Musk thinks.
But there are absolutely orders of magnitude of improvement in the system. And this is why, you know, it's fun to come to, for most of my life, the powers that be have had great certainty that they're doing exactly the right thing and that they know what they're doing and everything's going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that cracking now. You see that cracking in favor of what maybe we don't know what we're doing. The last book that I'd recommend, you know, I was a libertarian really until I started to read Thomas Carlyle. And it was Carlyle that pointed me. When I think of libertarianism, let me leave you this analogy. It's like Newtonian physics. It's true within its own context. It's true within an envelope. It's true within a certain environment, but it is not true in general. Like Newtonian physics is just wrong, but in most cases, you can just abuse it. Same is true of classical liberals. It's just like, great, let's have competition, let's have freedom, let's have capitalism.
And what's your quantum physics? Because maybe that encompasses general relativity.
Yeah, so once you're into relativity, basically you're like, oh, you have to include Liszt as well as Mises. You have to include Schmidt as well as Hayek. You have to include, I mean, Schmidt's doctrine of the exception is like essentially Einstein. You know, what Schmidt is saying to libertarians is you're trying to get a system with no government and it's an unstable equilibrium. It's like a pencil balanced on its point. You can get it almost vertical, but if you create a system where it's just like, okay, pure rule of law, first of all, who enforces that it's pure rule of law? That has to be someone who's above the law. But, you know, even if you solve, you know, that problem, that power that is above the law has to have the power of exceptions.
There's a way out.
Or something will take advantage of it. In English political history, it's called the royal prerogative.
Unless the law is nature.
Ah, but how does nature enforce its law? You know, there are two senses of natural law. You have the sense of natural law in the sense of natural law that we can observe. So natural law would say castaways on a desert island where there is no government, there's no positive law, but everybody can tell that it's wrong to steal from each other. Then you have another category of natural law, which is self-enforcing natural law, like the blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
It's great, but I don't think it can apply to everything on every way. And one last thing, you know, reading Carlyle is very important because Carlyle will tell you, you can't quantify everything, you can't have a metric, you can't eliminate the exception. The attempt to produce an algorithm that would replace politics is one of the great, Carlyle's phrase was the government is carried on by steam.
Changing proof of work for proof of work.
Well, yes, and there are many things that can be solved with proof of war that cannot be solved with proof of work. And the idea of we can do with a proof of war in the 20th century did not lead to a little utopia. And actually, like, anyone who looks at, if you read, again, if you read Battelle's Law of Nations, which is really the Bible of the old multipolar order, it will tell you that if you don't have the right to go to war, you're not actually a country. You could just part of something.
They can call you a fluke. How do you call it in this game?
Call your bluff.
You call your bluff.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, if you can't go to war, you're not a country. And what's interesting is that you would think the condition of Europe today under American hegemony is very similar to the condition of Greece under the Roman Empire. And just militarily, structurally. But it sort of goes past that because you would think, Athens used to have an army, they used to put all this GDP into fighting, people would get killed, right? And then the Romans come in and are like, hey, Athens, why don't you just write beautiful plays and poems and just be Athens, right? And as soon as you say that to Athens, Athens is not Athens anymore because the energy that created all those beautiful plays and poems was the energy of sovereignty and the energy of contending for power. And you take that away and you basically just kind of neuter these people. And it's a fact that nobody really cares.
You pretend to take it away.
Ah, well.
Still there. Power is still there.
Power is still there, but it is, if power has actually been pulled in, if real power, remember this design with the all orbital authority, all power that isn't basically rise from God and death from space is simulated.
But couldn't it be that there's orthogonal ways of ruling? If you have the rods of God, you don't have the intelligence of seeing, maybe I don't like you and I'm thinking of ways of not paying taxes to you and I can optimize the system.
And basically, develop some, one day, I have 1,000 lasers that you've never seen before and they shoot down your rods from God. It's true. Only the dead has seen the end of war. And so creating a system that is both very stable, designing a system that is both very stable and really has no incentives that drive you toward these failure modes, nothing is ever perfect. But like when I think about this system and then, Europe is amazing in many ways because like, you come here and they're just like, in America, they're just like little patches of something that might look almost as good as the hillside of St. Gallen. If you go to Tamalpais and Moran, the weather's better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's just like people quite like cats and dogs in America who live in one of the like four, six neighborhoods in four cities that are like Europe.
But of course that had to happen. There's much more variance in the US population.
The future is not ordained. And you drive around, for example, Northern California and it's full of hilltops and you're just like, I can put a beautiful Italian hilltop town on every one of these things. Why do we have to live this way? Why do we have to live in this like sterile, stinking, broken American way? And then just like, wow, that is so much better than the third world. And the third world is really completely at our doorsteps. The default future, I'm designing this science fiction, fantasy world or whatever, the default future is simply the third world because we already, I don't know if there's anyone in this building, if you talk to them, could say, I'm going to defend the idea that human rights as a human being should depend on the GPS coordinates where your mother is squeezed you out. This is already becoming, you know, the only country that has this just use soli is the United States, and it's becoming this ridiculous thing with birth floors and where pregnant women just fly over from China en masse to get U.S. passports for their babies. It's utterly...
We have other ridiculous proxies, like the process of getting citizenship. Maybe it's not getting squeezed out of a vagina, but it's getting squeezed into a bureaucracy.
Yeah, but that bureaucracy, I mean, getting citizenship in Switzerland is hard. It at least bears, you know, some resemblance to reality. But my point is slightly different. Like, if you ask people in this room to say, oh, where you're allowed to live should be a function of the GPS coordinates of your birth.
Mm-hmm.
Your moral rights to human being and geographical position, that's bizarre. And then you're like, oh, well, it's not, shouldn't be position, actually. It should be the race of your parents.
Yeah, but there's space, the space and time. So what if you change the other coordinate? Your human rights depend on your time. What if I was born 3,000 years ago? Of course I wouldn't have any rights. So why if you change the
coordinate? I haven't reached my punchline yet. In a way... What is the difference between Switzerland and South Africa? The difference between Switzerland and South Africa is the people who are in Switzerland and are allowed to be in Switzerland. And the fact that Switzerland has immigration laws that prevent 20 million Angolans from coming here tomorrow is a legacy, as we say. It is not something, if we had open borders, if that was the default and that was the inertia, almost no one would be able to come up with any moral basis on why we should close the borders, much less expel the 20 million Angolans from Switzerland. But Switzerland with 20 million Angolans is just South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And you would live as they live in South Africa today, which is very badly and very unsafely.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's one of the many truths that, like, open borders libertarians do not really understand. They should spend more time in the third world. So, yeah, we have this very, very serious, like, the situation is actually serious enough that designing completely novel structures and completely novel forms of government and policy, and I could go on in this basically, in towards tomorrow morning. But we should, we should hang it up. This was very good. And
it's a pleasure.
A great pleasure.